Hey there, Here and Now Anytime listener. If you like this show, we'd love it if you followed us or subscribed wherever you get your podcasts. Just look for Here and Now Anytime. Also, I know you hear this a lot, but if you can leave a rating or a review while you're at it, we would really appreciate it. It just takes a second and it helps us a lot. Of course, you can also tell your friends to subscribe. That helps too. And thanks. Now here's the show.
As far as I'm concerned, this is a hostile takeover.
The Texas Education Agency is stepping in to run the state's largest school district, and teachers in Houston are not happy about it. It's Friday, March 17th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Today on the show, a closer look at the conservative groups behind a wave of bills that make it harder for trans kids to get gender-affirming medical care. And communities in Illinois and Minnesota are fighting back against pipeline projects, but these aren't transporting oil or gas. They're carrying carbon dioxide. But first, as we just heard from Jackie Anderson of the Houston Federation of Teachers, there's consternation in the country's eighth biggest school district after the state of Texas said this week it's going to replace Houston's superintendent and board of trustees. In a minute, we'll hear from one of the teachers' unions. But first, let's get up to speed with Houston Public Media's Dominic Anthony Walsh. He spoke to Scott Tong earlier today.
The administration of Governor Greg Abbott, a Republican, says the Houston Independent School District has systemic problems, and therefore they announced this takeover. What problems do they cite?
Right. They're talking about a few schools, one in particular failing to meet state standards for several years. The Texas Education Agency actually first tried to do this back in 2019, but the move was held up in court until January of this year. Since then, there's been improvement in a lot of schools, but they make the point that there are still some schools that don't meet state standards.
I understand one specific school at the center of this fight historically is Wheatley High School, historically low scores. Briefly, what happened there?
Right. So Wheatley High School failed to meet state standards for several years in the lead up to 2019. It also didn't meet state standards during Hurricane Harvey recovery. So this is a school that serves a predominantly low-income Black and Latino community. And a lot of advocates basically say that the standards system doesn't take into account all of the factors that a school like Wheatley faces. And also, it received a passing grade last year while this move was still held up in court.
Oh, I see. So by some measures, things are getting better at Wheatley.
Right. And more than three quarters of the schools that previously did not meet state standards met them last year.
So this takeover in Houston, will this change things in the classroom? Will this change, say, school budgets?
So it depends how aggressively the board of managers appointed by the state to replace the elected school board members, it depends how aggressively they act. They will have complete power over the district when they're appointed in June. They will keep that power for at least 2 years, most likely longer, essentially indefinitely. And what they decide to do with classroom curriculum, library books, the expansion of charter schools, the whole host of policies that they have power over, that'll determine how much this move trickles down to the classroom level. So we'll see, essentially.
That's Dominic Anthony Walsh, reporter for Houston Public Media. Dominic, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Scott.
Let's talk now to Zeph Capo, president of the Texas American Federation of Teachers. The union is against the takeover plan. Zeph, welcome.
Thank you.
What will this takeover mean for teachers in the Houston district?
Well, that's certainly a great concern of ours. Our Houston teachers have really gone through a lot over the last several years, from the hurricane to massive budget crises to increasing accountability standards with little to no support to meet those standards. And if the plan coming in is more doubling down of punitive types of measures and policies, then I think we're going to see even more exodus from our classrooms, which has been, one of the major hurdles that we've been trying to overcome.
Now, the state government has cited what it calls systemic problems and years of low academic ratings in the Houston Independent School District. This takeover is also supported by State Representative Harold Dutton, a Democrat representing part of Houston. He spoke earlier this week. Let's take a listen.
What this is about is changing the outcome for thousands and thousands of kids, particularly those in Northeast Houston. And so while people are beating me up and beating up the commissioner and saying all kinds of crazy things, at the end of the day, failing schools destroys this democracy.
Zeph, what do you say to this argument that this is about better outcomes for students?
So Representative Dutton has been in that spot for probably three decades now, and one of the major factors that he consistently forgets about is that our schools do not operate in vacuums. As a matter of fact, another one of our Houston delegation coined a term earlier this week that we have a state-engineered failure of our district due to chronic underfunding, due to chronic lack of attention. But I want to take a minute to walk outside the schools, because what we need from representatives like Mr. Dutton is help ensuring that we can actually do our jobs. That means parents have to have jobs that provide decent wages so that they can feed their kids and have a stable roof. We've got to have environments where kids aren't walking through toxic chemical waste dumps to be able to get to school. We need to be able to support school funding so that school districts like Houston and Wheatley in particular aren't hundreds of dollars below the state average for per pupil funding, which is already thousands of dollars below the national average for per pupil funding across the country. Like, those are things that he's actually failed on delivering for his community for multiple years, for multiple decades. So it's no wonder that our schools are struggling for the last several years.
And Zeph, quickly, there are also accusations of problems on the current board. The state describes what it calls chaotic meetings and an alleged bribery scheme that led the former board president to plead guilty or to be indicted. Has the board, which is being replaced, been problematic?
Absolutely. We certainly can't defend the wrongs of the board, but the concerns that we have, one of the investigatory reports the state leans on to make their claim, we have an understanding that the main witness for that report was actually the high-level staffer who was arrested by the FBI and potentially that same school board member that they're citing.
Zeph Capo of the Texas American Federation of Teachers, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, Anthony Brooks speaks with a reporter who obtained emails between several conservative organizations and state lawmakers as they coordinated to push bills restricting gender-affirming care for transgender youth. What she found after the break.
This year alone, at least 31 state legislatures have introduced bills that target transgender youth, according to the ACLU. These bills seek to make it more difficult or block trans kids from receiving gender-affirming medical care. In many cases, these bills are not the result of grassroots activism. Instead, they are pushed by a national network inspired by the religious right. Madison Pauley, a reporter at Mother Jones, writes about this in her piece Inside the Secret Working Group that helped push anti-trans laws across the country. And she joins us now. Madison Pauley, thanks so much for joining us. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start by talking specifically about what these bills are trying to do. What kind of legislation are we talking about here?
Right. So these are bills that are designed to restrict the ability of transgender people to access medical treatments that affirm their gender identity. That medical care usually means puberty blockers for pubescent children to sort of give them more time as they're growing up before they enter puberty, where their bodies start changing. Cross-sex hormones for teenagers or adults, and almost exclusively for adults, surgeries. So these bills primarily target minors, so people under 18, The enforcement is different from bill to bill,
right,
but the end goal is the same, to roll back medical care for trans kids.
Tell us something about the groups behind this wave of legislation. Who are they?
Absolutely. So back in 2019, when one of the first significant bills to do this was being crafted, you had this whole slate of conservative, often religious, interest groups weighing in. So that includes the Alliance Defending Freedom. They are a religious right legal behemoth. They have been behind drafts of sports and bathroom bans targeting trans kids in public schools. In the past, they've defended state-sanctioned sterilization of trans people in Europe. And they've also been involved in a lot of Supreme Court cases with implications for LGBTQ rights. Another group is the American College of Pediatricians. They have sort of an innocent-sounding name. It sounds like the American Academy of Pediatricians. But they're actually far more of a fringe group. And both of these groups, Alliance Defending Freedom, American College of Pediatricians, have strong anti-LGBTQ views and also strong anti-abortion views. They're heavily involved in that fight as well.
I see. Now, your reporting is based on a series of emails that you obtained between local lawmakers and these organizations in the anti-trans movement. What did you learn from these emails?
Right. Yes, the emails that I got cover the period from 2019 to 2020 mainly, which is right when we started seeing the first coordinated effort. The emails essentially are proof of the Alliance Defending Freedom, AC PEDS, and other groups being involved from the very beginning. This bill in South Dakota that was introduced in 2020 by Representative Fred Deutsch, according to the emails, was workshopped by these groups, both the bill language, talking points, responses to opposition. They came up with testimony together, all to push this bill in 2020. And while it failed that year in South Dakota, bills with language that's very similar to it were introduced in 9 other states beyond it. So already you can start to see this national coordinated push emerge. And I think having evidence of these groups, some of which are classified as anti-LGBTQ hate groups by the Southern Poverty Law Center behind it, was very telling and very revealing to me.
Right. I want to ask you sort of a big picture question about this, because in pretty much any big picture debate around policy, you're going to have advocacy groups and lobbyists working with politicians. There's nothing illegal about that. But in what ways is this troubling to you? I mean, in what ways are you troubled by these national conservative and religious groups coming into states and really helping to shape this kind of legislation?
Right. I mean, it's a great point. This is how the sausage is made often. And that's actually what the ADF said to me when I went to them for comment on this story. They said lawmakers often seek advice from experts in law, policy, medicine, and other fields as they craft legislation. But even though it might not be illegal, I think it really matters. And I think it matters to residents of all the different states who has influence on their legislators, who has influence on their laws. And so when you go back to these laws being edited, being workshopped, their talking points being honed by groups that have been designated by the Southern Poverty Law Center as anti-LGBT hate groups, have long sort of robust histories of opposing LGBTQ rights, that I think matters to the people who are standing up and trying to figure out, is this something that I support in my state? Is this something that I think my legislators should be supporting themselves?
Right.
This legislation may seem to be more organic if you don't know all of this backstory, which, you know, has been hidden, I think, from most people's view for a long time, especially if you're just looking in your own state in a sort of isolated battle over one bill, you might not see the larger picture of these same bills being introduced over and over and over in different places.
Right.
It's also not uncommon for the people who are in support of these restrictive laws to say, you know, we were approached by concerned parents. One of the groups that shows up in the emails that I received, called the Eagle Forum of Alabama, has said in a recent press release that parents, concerned parents, were the reason that they got involved in pushing the ban on gender-affirming care in their state, which did ultimately pass and is currently on hold in court. So what these emails show is that, in the words of one of their staff members, they were coached by this lawmaker in South Dakota, and they were coached by the American College of Pediatricians to lead a coalition bringing this. It may appear to be more organic if you're just taking the supporters of this legislation at their word for who really wants this.
Yeah, I want to ask you about messaging here. You found that one of these groups, the Liberty Council, advised an anti-trans group to avoid using words like transgender, cisgender, or non-binary, because they say that using the other side's language to frame the debate would hurt their cause. Mm-hmm. So what's the importance that you see in language in particular in this debate, and how these groups are using language?
Yeah, Anthony, I think that's really key, because in that quote from the emails in particular, you see this insistence that they cannot acknowledge that trans people exist. Hmm. And that's a common theme that comes up throughout the emails, is a belief that no one is truly transgender. They use other words, other language, like lie, delusion, insane, to characterize the idea that anyone might identify as transgender, especially young people. So you see this come up in the way that they craft the bill language. They tried to write in a way that would avoid referring to gender as a discrete concept from sex. First, they tried language like children who have an incorrect perception of their sex, or whose perception of their sex does not match their sex. They're trying to find language that doesn't even acknowledge this idea that people can have a gender identity that does not match their sex assigned at birth.
Right. Finally, Madison, talk a little bit about the greatest takeaway for you about the groups behind this current wave of legislation.
I think the greatest takeaway for me is that this network is truly been nationwide since the beginning. You have this lawmaker who the reporting centered on, Fred Deutsch in South Dakota. You also had a representative in Idaho, Julianne Young, who is pushing a bill that the same group helped to craft that would have stopped people from changing the gender marker on their birth certificate. You have references to Representative Anthony Sabatini in Florida, who introduced a Vulnerable Child Protection Act, quote unquote, that year in 2020, and Representative Ginny Earhart in Georgia, who agreed to do so after being approached by some of the members of this group. All of this is documented in the emails. So today, as we see, 31 states, like you mentioned earlier, have these bills or bills that would accomplish the same thing, even if they don't use the same exact language. It really shows that this was a coordinated effort from the beginning, as you see this network acting behind the scenes.
Hmm. Well, that's Madison Pauley of Mother Jones. Her latest piece is entitled Inside the Secret Working Group That Helped Push Anti-Trans Laws Across the Country. Madison, thanks so much for joining us today, and thanks for your reporting.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, the latest pipeline wars aren't over how to transport oil or gas, but carbon dioxide. How communities in the Midwest are fighting back against carbon capture and storage pipelines. After the break.
The battle over plans to build a new pipeline is heating up in Illinois. It's not an oil or gas pipeline. Instead, it would carry liquid carbon dioxide captured from the burning of fossil fuels. Critics say the process, known as carbon capture, is unproven, risky, and not a long-term solution to the climate crisis. And farmers are putting up a fight against building the project across their lands. Nara Schoenberg has been reporting on this for the Chicago Tribune and joins us now. Nara, good to have you.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So we're talking about a project called the Navigator CO2 Project that would transport liquid carbon dioxide from South Dakota, Minnesota, Nebraska, Iowa, and Illinois to underground storage sites in Illinois. So remind us what carbon capture is and how this pipeline would be different from a regular oil or gas pipeline.
Right. Carbon capture is when you remove carbon either from the smokestacks of factories or fossil fuel plants, or actually directly from the air. Here we're talking about removing it from industrial plants, ethanol plants, fertilizer plants, and we're talking about storing it underground.
Right. Now, we'll get into why environmentalists have long opposed this, but as you report, farmers are joining forces to fight the construction of this pipeline. Why are they so opposed to it?
Yeah, farmers are really concerned because Navigator wants to send carbon dioxide pipelines under their fields. There are concerns that this would mess with expensive underground drainage systems, hurt property values, lower crop yields. There's a whole range of concerns there. There are also safety concerns.
Right. And as you report, a lot of these farmers are, like a lot of farmers are everywhere. I mean, they're really attached and have history, long family ties to this land, and they're really concerned about upsetting that, right?
Right. These are farmers who have been on their land for generations. I talked to one who'd been on his land, his family's been on the land for 100 years, and he has a really almost spiritual connection to the land and the idea that carbon dioxide pipelines could be sent through his fields against his wishes. It feels like a real violation to him.
Right. Now, a report from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign recently found that Illinois is set to become a leader in carbon capture because of this unique underground rock that is treasured by these companies. Can you talk a little bit about what's so special about this rock?
Yes, we have sandstone, and sandstone is a great medium for storing liquid carbon dioxide. That's because it's both porous, meaning it has spaces for the liquid to sit in, and it's also permeable. The spaces are connected in ways that allow you to inject carbon dioxide and have it spread through the stone and cover large areas and be stored in large amounts.
Right. So it's seen as a possible solution to climate change, a place to store these gases. But environmentalists have long derided carbon capture as risky and unproven. It also has a history of poor performance. Can you talk a little bit about that? What's gone wrong with carbon capture?
Yeah, carbon capture, in theory, is a great idea. You remove 90% of the carbon from, say, a coal plant or a fossil fuel plant. You remove it before it goes out into the air, and you have what some people have called clean coal. It sounds really good, but there are a bunch of issues that some pretty important climate scientists have been bringing to the fore in recent years. Some of it has to do with economics, that these plants, when they go up in large scale, they tend to close down. The economics just don't work. But there are also questions about whether they're really doing their job of removing carbon from the atmosphere. I talked to Mark Jacobson at Stanford, who did a really interesting study that found this big carbon capture project that was really seen by the industry as kind of a standout, Petranova in Texas, that when you calculated what it was really doing and looked at the emissions it takes to run carbon capture, that the plant was really only removing about 10 to 20% of the carbon that it would be ejecting into the atmosphere. So it wasn't doing a good job.
It can also be risky because CO2 can leak out of these underground storage sites. And I understand that this actually happened in Mississippi in 2020 with some pretty terrifying results. What happened there?
That was a pipeline rupture in Setarsha, Mississippi in 2020. One of the rescue workers described the scene afterwards. He compared it to a zombie apocalypse. The carbon in liquid form escapes. When the pipeline ruptures, it turns into this cloud of gas, which is potentially suffocating to humans. It also stops cars on the road. There were cars because engines need oxygen to run, just like we do. There were cars that were stalled out on the road because they came in contact with this cloud. People passed out. People were foaming at the mouth. Dozens of people went to the hospital.
Mm. And what do you think the fight over these pipelines says about the future of carbon capture as a viable strategy for reducing greenhouse gas emissions?
Yeah, we're definitely a test case. I'd say, you know, we're probably in the early phases of it. There are questions about whether people would be more comfortable with this if there was more regulation. And I think Illinois is going to move forward with some regulation. But certainly, it's another potential barrier for carbon capture, which, you know, increasingly does face barriers.
That's Nara Schoenberg. She's a reporter for the Chicago Tribune, talking about opposition to a carbon capture project out in Illinois. Nara, thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's not the only fight over energy and land use we're following. Head to hereandnow.org to hear what an investigation by the NPR Climate Desk revealed about the organized opposition to local solar projects. Some seemingly grassroots groups can be traced to conservative operatives trying to stymie renewable energy. That's at hereandnow.org. This show comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's stories were produced by Jill Ryan, Catherine Swartz, and Sam Rafelson. Todd Munt, Peter O'Dowd, and Gabe Bullard edited today's show. Technical direction from Caleb Green and Max Liebman. Theme music by me, Max, and Mike Moschetto. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin, and the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening, and happy St. Patrick's Day, everybody. We'll be back Monday.